and the ethical landmines. But she also stoked that fire burning within me to dig for the story, to find the truth, and then to turn around and tell it to the public accurately, artfully, ethically, and well. That is what she taught, and those are the principles I try to adhere to today. There is no doubt in my mind that had I not possessed the humility to ask her over and over again for help, and had I not listened to her when she gave it to me, I would never have survived my first years in the network news business. Even now, when I have doubts and concerns, and I do, I call her for guidance. She remains one of my best friends, and I'm so proud that she stayed clean to this day. Lesson from the trenches. God puts mentors in your path. They may not look like you, sound like you, or be what you expect, but they always know more than you, and that's the whole point. Use them. If you don't find one at the beginning of your career, that's okay. Keep your eyes open. Mentors will cross your path later on. They transmit the lessons you need to learn, like this next one. Chapter 4. Your behavior has consequences. Ouch! Welcome to adulthood. Your parents, your friends, society, the business world, no one but you is responsible for how you conduct yourself. You are not a victim. The single most important determining factor in your life is you. And it's never too early to get your ethical act together. Be strong about what you believe in. Be firm about who you really are, the pluses and the minuses. Know what you will and won't do to get ahead. Know what you can and cannot live with. Believe me, this is a big one. Your job will test your ethics and therefore teach you ethics every day. Let's face it, life after college is different with a capital D. You're out in the real world full time and people expect you to act accordingly. But you're not a cork bobbing on the wild and wicked ocean tossed and turned by powers beyond your control, even if it does feel that way. Other people's ethics do not have to be yours. You and you alone are responsible for how you behave. Yes, you do have to learn the rules of engagement in your chosen field, but if you ignore what you know to be the difference between right and wrong, you'll pay a huge price. And I'm not just talking about losing sleep. I think it's pretty safe to assume if you have a great job, someone else has an eye on it too. What will you do to keep that awesome job? To what lengths will you go? I found myself asking those questions not all that long after I got to CBS News. As I was getting better on the air, there was a well-known anchorwoman who also happened to be a friend of mine. The network had hired her with great fanfare, as usual, but it turned out she wasn't bringing in the ratings. It was no surprise in the morning news business, a meat grinder that chews people up and spits them out, that the network wanted her out. God forbid they should tell her to her face. No, instead, I was asked to start doing things I knew were designed to make her feel insecure. For instance, find out what stories she wanted to cover, then do them myself. Shoot on-camera intros live from her anchor desk right next to her. Anything I could do to breathe down her neck and make her feel threatened. Keep in mind, these were grown-ups with big jobs who were hoping that this woman would just buckle under the pressure and leave on her own. And I was the obvious anchor in waiting, ready to plunk right down in her chair. I've since learned that this kind of maneuvering is standard operating procedure for lots of network executives. They're quick to come up with these strategies and probably forget about them the next day. But I was so new at the game, it all made a deep impression on me. I went to one of them and said, you know, this isn't my style. I want the job, but not that way. Now, I'm no Mother Teresa. I admit I did think about doing what they wanted in order to get the promotion. After all, it would have been easy to rationalize. These people had powerful network jobs because they were older and wiser than me, and that's just the way the business is. But that's just not true. I can't blame the boss or the business if my own foot steps across an ethical line. If my gut tells me it's wrong, that's the signal not to do it. I can't know it's wrong and do it anyway and then blame the corporate culture to get myself off the hook. I'm the one who's responsible for my actions. Bottom line, I refused to squeeze out my friend. She moved on anyway, and I never had to be embarrassed when I looked her in the eye nor feel I'd done something evil to her. And those people who asked me to do those things, they don't have those great big jobs anymore. Here's another story to illustrate my point. Years later, a producer sent me out to do a follow-up on a story we had worked on together. After a month of setting it up, I made a final call to our story subjects to confirm our shooting arrangements. They revealed in an offhand way that the producer had bought the rights to their story, hoping to sell it as a TV movie. Whoa. I realized right there and then that he was using me and the show to promote his own TV project. I knew it was wrong. In fact, we're not allowed to do TV news stories for personal profit, and the producer's own gut must have told him it was wrong too, because he had kept it a secret. I was hurt and confused. I was also furious because if I put my name and face on the story, people would think I must have known about the business arrangement and therefore condoned it. I immediately took myself off the assignment. Consequence, a great story was killed, a working relationship was damaged, and the producer's reputation took a hit. And in the news business, as in many others, your reputation is everything. We all develop our own ethical standards. Figure out exactly where is that fine line we won't cross. And my gut tells me there's more at stake than just right and wrong. It's probably the Black Irish in me, but I also adhere to the superstition that what goes around comes around and bites you in the butt. So watch it. As the competition in the news business stiffens, the pressure has grown unbelievably intense. There are more shows, more producers, more people like me competing for the same great get, the top interview subject of the day. There's an almost unbearable temptation to tear down someone else in order to further yourself. I'm talking about bad-mouthing the competition to get the subject to talk to me and not to her. Oh, you don't want to do her show. It's not prestigious enough. My audience is much bigger. Anyway, she won't mind doing you after I do. Believe it or not, that's what sometimes goes on among the high-pay, high-profile correspondents competing for the top interviews. Now, I don't want to sound holier than thou. To be truthful, I've engaged in these conversations. If you don't do my show first, forget it. I can't do it. That kind of manipulation has come out of my mouth more times than I care to admit. In fact, it wasn't until a well-known woman in my business told me she'd heard what another well-known journalist had said about her that I really started to watch my words when I make my pitch. Winning by running down my competitors isn't the kind of person I want to be. The question is, how do you get your gut to talk ethics to you? You already know how. The ethical and spiritual lessons you've learned from your parents, your teachers, and your religion are internalized down there and talk back to you, guiding you through life. The problem is hearing it. When the pressure is intense, you have to take the time to stop and have a conversation with yourself, reflecting on what your own ethics are, what you've been taught. And the process never stops, which is why we need mentors. They not only teach us how to do our work, they teach us the specific ethical principles of our profession. When I first got to CBS News, they made me read and reread the CBS News Standards and Practices Manual. And my crazy producer went one better. She bludgeoned me with them, so I learned the wrongs and the rights of the journalistic practice. Don't stage anything on a story, she would say. We just record what happens. We don't make it happen. Don't tell someone you're doing a story about one thing when it's really about something else. Don't let a story subject buy or give you anything, she would say. Don't. That was my foundation. As you go along, make sure you identify people whose professional lives and ethical choices you admire. Then if you're asked to do something dicey or questionable and you get a slight gnawing in your gut, ask. They'll give you the additional ethical and spiritual guideposts you need as you pursue your own success. Sometimes your teachers pop up unsummoned. After I'd been at CBS News for a while, I did some pieces for yet another now-defunct magazine show. This day, we were at an Orange County, California trailer park that had been there since the county really was mostly orange groves. But now developers were seizing the land and throwing the people out. At a nighttime residence meeting, one of the organizers said, "We have a special visitor with us, Maria Shriver of CBS News." People applauded and cheered, and I took that as a signal to go up to the front of the room and make a little speech. I went into full-on rousing Democratic Party Up With the People campaign mode. I told them how glad I was to be able to get their side of the story out, that they were being mistreated by big business, and that they were the little people whose voice deserved to be heard. I got a standing ovation. Flush with victory, I returned to my crew in the back of the room. Whereupon the cameraman, a veteran newsman, one of the original electronic cameramen in this country, yanked me outside. "Don't you ever do that again," he said. "You are a journalist, not a politician. You are not here to further anybody's cause. You are here to get the people's side of the story, then to get the developer's side of the story, and then tell the story honestly and fairly and get out. That's it." They didn't applaud you because you're such a great reporter. They cheered you, he said, because you're a celebrity. What you did in there was unprofessional. Don't do it again. I know if he didn't care about me, he could have videotaped that little disaster and gotten me fired. He didn't, and I learned one more lesson from one more loving teacher. The life lessons my own parents gave me are probably the ones I've most relied on. If I had known how much I'd need them in my profession, I would have listened even better. My father has always been highly respected because he carries himself with intelligence, humor, dignity, and class. He's the one who taught me it's never worth stabbing someone in the back to get ahead. He said that talent and smarts always win out, that if you're good, you'll get the great job. He said never let a puffed-up ego make your decisions for you. That's a hard one if you're a driven person like me, because chances are you've got a sizable ego too. He taught me to check my ego and make sure to have people around me honest enough to tell me when my overreaching ego is about to get the better of me. My mother is the one who taught me to be a bulldog, to forge my own way around and through problems and obstacles. Like my father, she's a stickler for honesty and responsibility. She told me and taught me, by example, that when I screwed up, I should admit it, take responsibility for it, not blame it on anyone else, and then move on. My parents also instilled in me a strong work ethic. They taught me to respect people who show up day in and day out to do a full day's work for a full day's pay, to admire people who work at two and even three jobs to take care of their families. My mother always said, "You're lucky to have a job and lucky to do something you love." My parents also infused in their children the necessity for community service, to give back some of what was given to us. My father started the Peace Corps and the Job Corps in the 1960s. My mother went against all known theories about what mentally disabled people could do and started the Special Olympics. All of my parents' programs give people an opportunity to volunteer, get involved, share the abundance. This is a family tradition that enriches our spirits, and my husband and I are trying to pass the gift along to our children so they'll grow up world-centered instead of self-centered, with generous hearts like their grandparents. My mother also drilled this important message into me: don't depend on your looks. Every time people would tell me I was attractive, my mother would be right behind them warning me that the world was filled with attractive women, that looks came and went, and if I wanted to achieve anything in life, I'd have to do it with my brains. Now, my appearance has definitely helped me, no doubt about it. In the television business, it always helps to look good. But I believe it's also a profession where you can survive and succeed only if you're tough, tenacious, smart, and careful about your reputation. You cannot survive if you cut corners, lie, or bend the truth. Lesson: situational ethics just don't cut it. The end, the dream job, does not justify the means, screwing a colleague. I don't want to sound preachy and self-righteous, but the world is rife with bribery and fraud and scandal and every kind of white-collar crime. The pressure and temptations are great. But when I say your behavior has consequences, I'm not just talking about going to jail or losing a night's sleep. What's at risk is your good name, your reputation. It's bigger than the promotion, the money, or the deal. It's who you are. Don't give it away so fast. Chapter 5, Be Willing to Fail. I'm sorry to have to tell you this, but many of you will experience failure in the pursuit of your passion. Many of you will fail to attain some of the goals or fulfill some of the dreams you have right now. But it's incredibly important to understand that failing is part of learning. Fear of failure can paralyze you. If you don't risk looking ridiculous or inept or even stupid sometimes, you may stay secure, but you'll also stay the same. By avoiding failure, you're also avoiding life's richness. And what happens if you fail? It can be liberating. In fact, I found most people who've achieved great success also have experienced some great defeat. I wish someone had told me that on graduation day. Instead, everyone told me I could go ahead and do anything I wanted, be anyone I wanted to become, with no detours or U-turns in my path. The hidden message was this: if you fail, shame on you. Well, that's just not true. Remember, my first big goal out of college was to anchor a network news show? Well, I realized that dream 8 years later in 1985, when I became the co-anchor of the CBS Morning News. I recall every minute of that job as clearly as when I lived it. You can't imagine how thrilled I was to anchor that broadcast, or how much it meant to me to get equal billing and equal compensation with my co-anchor, Forrest Sawyer. In my mind, I was on my way. Now that I had this job, nothing could or would stop me. I was finally a member of the elite club of women anchoring the national morning shows. And to me, that was heaven. In fact, my head was so high up in the clouds that I was oblivious to the brutal behind-the-scenes maneuvering of network television executives back on Earth. Now, I wasn't a total idiot. I knew that when Forrest and I took over the CBS Morning News, it was in third place behind Good Morning America and the Today Show. I knew we were rookies following in far bigger footsteps than ours, bigger names who'd never been able to push the show into first place. But I assumed we'd be given a fair shot and dealt with openly and honestly. Guess I was still pretty naive. I tried not to pay too much attention to the reviews. Well, that's a little lie. How could I not pay attention when I was reading this in the Washington Post? Forrest Sawyer is partnered on the program with Maria Shriver's hair. Shriver does not look as if she cares about the answers to many questions except, where's my brush and what time will Arnold be home? Alrighty, it's going to be personal. Hair reviews. This is what we're up against. The scrutiny could be excruciating, but I tried to stay above it, sort of like staying above churning whitewater rapids on a little raft. I just figured when you got in this particular river, you were going to go for a ride. And a ride it was. During the time I anchored the morning news, there were three different executive producers, two men and a woman, all trying to prove themselves with three different agendas, three different concepts for fixing the show, and three different plans for making the anchors more appealing. In general, they thought Forrest was too stiff, and they wanted him to loosen up. As for me, they wanted a total overhaul, starting, of course, with my hair, which had made it into the Washington Post. Your hair, too long, cut it, it's much too distracting. Your hair, too dark, lighten it, blonde is better with breakfast. Your hair, it's too there. Your eyes, your voice, you're just too much in the morning. Don't laugh on the air. It's unprofessional. No more bright colors. You're too threatening to women. As you might imagine, with so much of me in need of fixing, I felt just a touch insecure. But since the producers were the ones running focus groups and doing audience research, I figured they had to know what they were talking about. I tried to keep my attitude really positive, and somehow over the year, with all the management zigzagging, we still move the ratings up to numbers they haven't seen since. I was proud of our work, and I was learning, evolving, and growing. After we'd been in the hot seat for almost a year, the network sent all the morning news shows to London to cover the royal wedding of Prince Andrew and Sarah Ferguson. It was the summer of 86, and I remember it clearly, not just because we delivered hours and hours of terrific live television, not just because we had great guests, and not just because the shows were lively, edgy, and interesting. I remember it because of what happened afterwards. The staff of our show congregated in the London Bureau, congratulating each other and speculating how long the royal marriage would last. What we didn't know was that the marriage would last longer than we would. The network president came into the London Bureau, and in the time-honored tradition of network executives everywhere, he congratulated us on our work, told us how wonderful our team was, and left. Later that same day, we got the word, by fax, that the morning news had been canceled. Not just Forrest and me, but the whole damn show. Boom, just like that, finished. As someone I know once said, hasta la vista, baby. Note, people in your business will lie to you. Some even will lie straight to your face. A tremendously shocking idea to me back then, call me naive or better yet, call me an idiot, because I should have seen the handwriting on the wall months earlier when this item appeared in the newspaper. Quote, newlywed Maria Shriver, co-anchor of the CBS Morning News, is expected to leave the job in several months for, quote, personal reasons, according to top sources at the network. She's eager to shed the grueling grind at CBS and move back to the West Coast to be with her husband full-time. Insiders report that CBS News management did not try to argue her out of the move. What? I was stunned. I'd never had any such conversation, never said any such thing, never even thought about it. Where'd they get that story? Isn't that silly, I thought. I asked my bosses about it, and they acted, and acted is the operative word here, shocked. They couldn't imagine where the newspaper got the story either. Oh, well, I told myself, it must not be true, so don't pay any attention to it. Yeah, right. I was too naive to know that the, quote, leak to the paper was a shot across the bow from the bosses who were quoted shortly thereafter as saying the following. We are very optimistic about the morning news with Maria Shriver and Forrest Sawyer, and we see no reason why we would make any changes in that lineup. See, I told myself, they love us. Well, months later, that was the guy who canned us. I was devastated, humiliated, and pissed off. I'd never really failed at anything. Oh, sure, there were little setbacks. Remember how I crashed and burned as a sound technician? But this was crashing and burning in public. The cancellation was in newspapers all over the country. And oh, sure, I'd learned in my family that politicians lost elections and came back. But tanking in television news seemed so permanent. I was mortified. My ego was decimated. How could this have happened to me? Wherever I went, I thought people were avoiding my glance. I had a dread disease. I'd been dumped. People treated me, I was sure, like I was contagious. They pitied me, for God's sake. What was I going to do now? My dream job gone. I was sure my career, if not my life, was over. Looking back, I know that sounds overly dramatic, but that's what I felt at the time. I thought I was finished, and quite sure that everyone else thought so too. But soon I discovered I was wrong. In my failure, I started to hear from others who'd been through the same thing. They opened up and shared their stories. Walter Cronkite told me that when he was, quote, retired from the CBS Evening News, he thought his career was over, if you can imagine that now. Barbara Walters told me what happened when she co-anchored the ABC World News Tonight and was canceled, which freed her up for the cosmic career she's had since. So many successful people told me they grew emotionally and were strengthened spiritually by falling somewhere along the road. It takes time, but it happens. For me, getting canned made me fearless about my career. It gave me the strength to follow my gut, to be myself on the job. In fact, I think I did some of my best work on the morning news after we got canceled. CBS News had given the show, the time period, the whole enchilada to the entertainment division. We had just one final month on the air. During that month, I didn't care about anything the powers that be had to say about my work or what we were doing. I'd lost all respect for them, their opinions, and the way they did business. Finally, I was free to be me on the air, and I felt great about it. If Forrest and I were both interested in an interview subject, then we did the interview together. A no-no on the show, but we didn't care. If an interview was going great, we let it run over time. We were more natural, and we ad-libbed a lot more. We heard from plenty of people who couldn't understand why the show was being nuked. Neither could we. The last day of the morning news was very emotional for all of us who'd come through the news wars together. Forrest gave me a bracelet inscribed, quote, "To my sister in arms." Management had offered me other jobs at CBS News, but I wanted out. When we signed off, I walked out of the CBS Broadcast Center on 57th Street, and I've never been back. I went home to Los Angeles, defeated, demoralized, and depressed, taking a bath in a well of self-pity. But I've learned that when you fail, it's important to grow from the experience. Use it. Don't let it define you or destroy you. Most of all, don't let it stop you. Pick your head up, dust off your ego, and do what you're most terrified to do. Get back on that horse and ride. 1 month later, I took a 70% pay cut for a job at NBC News. Back to being a reporter again. In a way, back to the beginning again. And this time with no producer mentor around. I was determined to work my way up again in stature and pay. And basically, I have. I may never achieve the prominence and visibility and hours of airtime the morning news gave me, but I did get my paycheck back up there and my self-respect. But best of all, I'm a different person today because I experienced that failure. I've learned how to handle disappointment and rejection. I've learned to hold my head up high and soldier on. And today, if someone suggests that I change my hair, alter my voice, or worse, cross an ethical line for a story, I tell them no from a position of inner strength and certainty. Because what can they do to me? Fire me or cancel my show? Been there, done that. And you know what? So have other people worth their salt. Today, I ask interview subjects what they regard as their greatest success and their greatest failure. Their failure stories illuminate their character far more than their successes. Often these people reveal that their greatest failure was permitting their personal lives to crack or crumble on the way to the top. Their honesty and openness has helped me stay focused on my priorities, what I want in my life. Lesson. Before I failed, my work was the focus of my life. It's where I put all of my intensity, intelligence, and effort. Never again will I make that mistake. Experiencing how suddenly I could lose my job, how quickly I could be replaced, how easily the workplace went on without me, made me determined to quit identifying myself through my career. Today, my work is a big and fulfilling part of my life, but it is not who I am. Who I am is far different from who I was before I failed, and I'd never trade the experience, which doesn't mean it didn't hurt. And to hell with what the Washington Post said about my hair. Chapter 6. Superwoman is dead and Superman may be taking Viagra. Not all of them, of course. My husband wants me to make very sure to tell you he is a Superman and that there's no Viagra within a 50-mile radius of our house. But seriously, I mean it when I say Superwoman is dead. That means you can't do it all. And even more important, you do not have to do it all. You can't have an exciting, successful, powerful career and at the same time win Mother of the Year award and be wife and lover extraordinaire. No one can. If you see successful, glamorous women on magazine covers proclaiming they do it all, believe me, you are not getting the whole story. Women have been beating themselves up with the Superwoman delusion for more than 20 years, and I, for one, think it's been harmful. When I graduated from college, the propaganda said the brass ring was within everyone's reach. I had an absolute conviction that if I applied myself, I'd be like Barbara Walters at work, yeah, in my dreams, and Mother Earth at home, always there, always patient, always kind, and still make the bed, plus dress like a model all the time, no sweatsuits, and rock and roll with my man at night. And trust me, if Martha Stewart had been on the scene then, I would have expected exquisite things for myself in the kitchen as well. But as my mother taught me, life is a marathon. It's an endurance event played out over time. Once I was freaking out to my mother about not being good enough in any area of my life, and she said, Maria, you can have and be all the things you want to be. Just do it over a lifetime. Don't try to do them all at once because you can't. If you try to, everyone around you will suffer, mostly you. It took me a long time to even begin to internalize that wisdom. Now you may say to yourself, what the hell is Maria talking about? She does have it all and she does do it all. Well, that's just not true. I don't do it all. My career isn't in the same league as Barbara Walters or Diane Sawyer's or Oprah Winfrey's. And I see women at my children's school who put June Cleaver and Martha Stewart to shame, not to mention me. My kids tell me about friends' mothers who sold their Halloween costumes. I'm in awe of these women. I can't thread a needle. Other kids' moms whip up gourmet dinners every night. My specialty is microwave popcorn. Forget about knowing the new math before the kids do or being really active in the PTA. And to hear my husband tell it, he's not getting enough of anything at home. There are so many areas where I can't claim competence, let alone mastery. But I've learned to do a few areas really well in the time I have and to ask for help with the rest. Most important is not beating myself up. It's a no-win situation if, no matter what I accomplish, I tell myself it's not good enough. I have to stop setting myself up to feel inadequate. The first way is to stop comparing myself, yourself, to anyone else. Comparing how you feel on the inside, which is bad, to the way someone else looks on the outside, great, is a losing proposition. It's an impossible standard. We will always come up short. Women in particular know what I'm talking about. We often compare ourselves to others in order to make ourselves feel bad. Here's Maria's recipe for feeling bad about myself. I carefully choose as a basis for comparison someone who has a stellar career. Then I ignore any other problems she has, any sacrifices she's chosen to make. Next, I discount any of my own assets, the talents, gifts, and abilities God gave me. Finally, I ratchet up my expectations for myself to way, way past what I'm capable of, and voila, I feel like dirt. It's a recipe for depression. Comparing yourself to others rarely is in the service of self-improvement. It's usually in the service of bludgeoning yourself into hopelessness. Overcoming this tendency has been a real struggle for me. I know I've been talking a lot about humility, but here we are again. Humility means accepting yourself with every plus and minus, every defect and asset, exactly as you are today. It's stepping back and appreciating the whole picture, where you are today, what you've done, what you want to do. Humility means neither beating the hell out of yourself nor glorifying mediocrity. Today's picture isn't set in stone. It will change. That's self-acceptance. My dad always drove that point home. You are you, and you are unique. He says anybody who gets to be with you, work with you, or share your life with you is goddamn lucky. I try to keep that thought with me as I travel down the road. You'll need to remind yourself frequently that you're a worthy human being, because there will be people on the road who'll make it their business to tear you down. And especially if you're a woman, you may want to do it yourself. I keep a little saying on my mirror that I read every morning and evening. It says, I am creative, I am powerful, and I can handle it. Obviously, there are times when I feel confused or inadequate, or I wouldn't have slapped that up on my mirror. I also keep in my wallet a yellowed note my dad wrote me many years ago. It says that I am special, that I am wise, and that he loves me. No matter what I fail to do on any given day, no matter how inadequate someone has made me feel, every time I read that note, I feel great. Feeling strong about yourself is what you'll need, because life and your own reaction to it may knock you off balance. Find some message, some thought, some prayer that helps you get there, and use it to get your strength back, yourself back. So don't set yourself up for failure by trying to win an award in every area of your life. But do set high standards for yourself. Decide what a realistic excellent means to you in each area and go for it. I'm not talking about settling. I'm talking about setting obtainable goals that will keep you stretching and growing. When I find myself in a rut and the stench of staleness is already creeping in, I try to shake myself awake by reassessing. For instance, for the last several years, I felt stupid and inadequate about computers. My 5-year-old thinks I'm allergic to CD-ROMs. Actually, I am. When I see a CD-ROM, I break out in self-doubt. I am an internet idiot. Now, I'd been utterly comfortable for years feeling dumb about computers. That's just who I am, I would think. Because I can be so self-critical, feeling stupid about something seems normal and natural, and I can just live with it. But in a fit of self-examination, I became totally conscious of the fact that I could actually change. What a genius. I made a New Year's resolution to learn more about computers than merely how to run the word processor on my NBC-issued laptop. And I'm determined to go online, which is as scary to me as going naked into a tornado on a unicycle. Now, years ago, I would have turned totally monomaniacal and bludgeoned my way through this one, too, applying myself to the computer 18 hours a day until I got as good as possible as soon as possible. Today, I'm more realistic about myself and the time I have. I'm not willing to sacrifice time with my kids or my work to this computer project. But I'm also not willing to use those obligations as an excuse to settle for mediocrity. So I'm setting my standard high, and I'm shooting for it, slowly and steadily. Where am I finding the spare time to become cyber savvy? I'm no longer lying around feeling bad about myself because I'm lying around. You'd be surprised how much time that frees up. The key is to stop concentrating on the negative and turn positive. I try not to strain for a goal that I can't possibly achieve. I reach forward, beyond myself, stretching for the limits of what I can achieve today. I must admit, I've learned some of this from my husband, who doesn't get paralyzed or beat himself up when he can't do something. He just keeps at it. And he's always learning something. He finds it pleasurable and satisfying. He looks for an activity where he cannot and tries to turn it into can, slowly, steadily, without embarrassment. He is totally willing to look like an idiot at tennis and golf in order to learn how to play. He has a ball doing it, laughing at himself. He just accepts that he'll never be as good as Pete Sampras or Tiger Woods, even when they were 12 years old. While striving for mastery, he just wants to keep improving, and he accepts wherever he is on the learning curve today. That's true humility, though in a million years, I never thought I'd use that word to describe him. But I do use that word to describe my mother. I hope and expect that when I'm her age, I will have experienced everything I wanted to do. I'll have had a fine career in broadcast journalism, and I'll be proud of it. I'll have helped raise our 4 miracles from God and hopefully not have been driven into the loony bin by them. I'll have been an awesome wife in every sense of the word, and my husband will have been lucky to have spent his life with me. I feel the same way about him, at least I do today. I'll have been a good sister, and I'll have honored, respected, and admired both my parents for who they are as individuals, as a couple, and most important, as parents. I'll be okay with the fact that I never reached as many people as Oprah Winfrey, never wrote like Emily Dickinson, never acted like Meryl Streep, and never baked like, help, she's everywhere, Martha Stewart. Your life is like a mosaic, a puzzle. You have to figure out where the pieces go and put them together for yourself. I have a young friend who just knew she could write a novel but wasn't doing it. She beat the living daylights out of herself for not being a starving artist. But at the age of 30, she met a mentor who told her if writing doesn't pay the bills, then stay at the job that does and write your novel after work. And that's exactly what she's doing now, pursuing her passion and loving her life. All we superwomen can ask of ourselves is to be outstanding, to keep at it, and to make peace with wherever we wind up. Lesson. Perfectionism doesn't make you perfect. It makes you feel inadequate. You are not worthless because you can't do it all. You are human. You can't escape that reality, and you can't expect to. Self-acceptance is the goal. If Shakespeare were a superwoman, she might have said, "To be or not to be takes time and wisdom." Chapter 7, Children Do Change Your Career, Not to Mention Your Entire Life. This is an extension of number 6, which says you can't do it all. Once you have children, you not only can't do it all, you can't do it the same way you were doing it before. In other words, once you start a family, don't expect to be the same hard-driving, workaholic, do-anything-go-anywhere worker you were. Because if you are, your children will suffer, and believe me, if you think your children are suffering, the guilt will make your work suffer. I waited a long time to start my family. I was 34 years old when our first daughter was born. And to tell you the truth, I was about as naive about child rearing as I was about the news business that first day at the Philadelphia station. In fact, parenting has turned out to be a far bigger challenge than anything my journalism career has dealt me. By the time our daughter was born, I was in love with my job. I was proud that after being fired, canceled, dumped from my highly visible post at the CBS Morning News 3 years before, I'd built myself back up at another network. I anchored 2 weekly NBC News broadcasts that I'd worked really hard to get and keep. Everyone told me my schedule was nuts, but not to me. I was in heaven. I anchored the weekend nightly news out of New York and also Sunday Today out of Washington, D.C. Not so bad, you say? Well, I was living across the map in Los Angeles. I commuted from Los Angeles to New York on Friday, then to D.C. late Saturday night, then back to the West Coast every Sunday. I loved the pace. I loved being out in the field doing stories, interviewing the likes of Corazon Aquino, Fidel Castro, King Hussein. I loved traveling, and I loved anchoring. I loved the people I worked with, and I loved the challenge of the job and the stature I'd attained. This is what I'd worked so hard for all those years. So when I got pregnant, I fully expected to keep visible on the air in both my anchor positions, because I couldn't imagine otherwise. Oh, sure, I might have to slow down the pace a tad, but hadn't I been told I could, should be able to do it all? I expected nothing less from myself, which is why I thought it was perfectly natural to have a morning sickness bucket next to the anchor chair, or tear to the bathroom to throw up during a commercial and then race back to the anchor desk in time to smile and say, "Welcome back to Sunday Today." I once even told the newspaper interviewer who asked me about having a family on one coast and a job on another, "I'm a firm believer, a religious person. I believe that God is watching over this and that I'll be able to do both." Saying that now, I can't believe how stupid I was, or arrogant might be a better word, being quite sure that what I wanted was what God wanted for me. Reality started to set in the first time I held my daughter. I fell deeply in love with my child and couldn't imagine being separated from her for 1 second. But even so, I held on to my unrealistic expectations with both fists, spending most of my maternity leave trying to figure out exactly how I was going to manage this child and the travel and the job. I just knew I'd be able to figure it out. But as I looked around me for guidance and paths to follow, I found none. Apart from the impossible-to-get morning news anchor jobs, which required hardly any travel, there were few network news jobs that seemed compatible with raising kids. And where were the role models? Many of the women who'd risen through the ranks before me had to be single-minded to get ahead in the male-dominated news business. Many just plain stayed single. Many were divorced. Many had no children. One big-time newswoman told me years later that she still felt guilty she had sacrificed child-rearing to career-building. And there was another pressure. My husband had made it clear he had no desire to live in New York, where the NBC News operation was based. His career was in Los Angeles and was much bigger than mine. So here I was with this beautiful baby and the man I loved in California, this job I loved in New York and Washington, and these stories I loved that were everywhere else. I went back to work and pretended that nothing had changed, commuting like a maniac. My baby was accumulating frequent flyer miles, but it didn't take me long to realize I was kidding myself. Nothing was working, neither motherhood nor the job. Whichever I was doing, I was worried and guilty about the other. Something had to give. I tried to convince my bosses to let me anchor at least one of the shows out of Los Angeles. No way, they said. I went back home and cried in frustration. On top of everything, the very helpful advice people offered confused me even more. Some people suggested I just quit working and stay home and raise my child. Unfortunate that that was an option financially, but it just wasn't emotionally. Others suggested I keep my jobs and everything would just magically work itself out because I was such a good person and deserved to get what I wanted. That wasn't happening at all. Finally, I went to the head of the network with my dilemma. I told him I didn't think I could do the two anchoring jobs at the level I'd been doing them and raise my child and keep my marriage together. But I told him I didn't want to lose all I'd worked for either. He understood, but also made it clear I had to choose. He told me that if I chose to give up my anchoring duties, other anchor opportunities would surely come along. Even though he was an honorable man, in TV news, a promise like that is an empty one. But there I was at a crossroads. With a great deal of sadness, I gave up my East Coast broadcasts, both of them. And of course, the anchor chairs were filled in 5 minutes. The TV news machine just rolled on, and I went home to Los Angeles. I'd like to tell you I felt relieved. The truth is, I felt like a failure again. So disappointed because I'd been unable to figure out how to have it all. Sure, I was still employed by the network doing one-hour specials, but I'd lost my power base, my own weekly shows. I was back to being a reporter, back to ground zero. Now, when I say ground zero, I know I'm being a drama queen. I know that really hitting bottom means being thrown out on the street with no job and no way to feed your kids. I know there are millions of women in truly dire situations who have only themselves to rely on. In fact, I seek out stories of women with children who have hit the bottom and pulled themselves up. I admire them, and I learn from their courage and their strength. Looking back now, I wish I hadn't wasted so much angst and so many tears on what, in fact, was my own choice. I was the one who chose to devote most of my time to my children and to work only part-time for NBC. And that's what I do to this day. I anchor and do pieces for a certain number of Dateline shows a year. My boss in New York works with me to find stories that don't involve too much travel, so I can tell myself it was worth my time away from my kids to do it. I anchor and report on at least 2-hour-long news specials of my own each year. For example, an hour broadcast about 4 women trying to get off welfare and into the job market in Wisconsin. And I have the great fortune to contribute to special coverage. Conventions, elections, the Olympics, inaugurations, and yes, impeachment hearings. And with all that, I still have a great deal of freedom and flexibility and go to the studio only when I need to. Keep in mind that when I made this arrangement with NBC more than a decade ago, I knew of no one else working part-time on a computer from home. And the head of the network did worry that if they opened that door for me, others would want to do it. But by then, I'd worked my butt off in TV news for 13 years, sometimes 7 days a week, up to 20 hours a day. There was no place I wouldn't go for a story, no assignment I'd turn down. So when I said I'd like to set up stories and do as much work as I could from home, they knew I wasn't going to sneak off to the beach in Malibu and get a tan. It was clear I'd continue to work my butt off, but only part-time, while having babies and raising our family. And they figured if it didn't work out, they could always can me. How lucky am I? Very. I chose to downsize my career, and my employers understood my priorities and have worked with me to help me maintain the strong and solid family life I wanted. Still, back when I made that choice, I felt so anxious and so guilty. Had I known that a decade later so many people would be working out of their homes, I would have cried less and felt less lonely. Maybe not less guilty. To this day, I get stabs of guilt that I have the opportunity to be fully involved in my kids' lives and still stay in a high-octane profession. I know that by working as long and hard as I did, I had a certain amount of power and clout, and that helped me get my way. If I'd had my 4 kids back at the beginning in Philadelphia or Baltimore, forget it. Let me say that I am more grateful to the women who walked before me and broke down the barriers. There is no doubt in my mind that I wouldn't be able to work part-time and raise my children if the women before me hadn't worked their butts off to prove that they could compete, that they were worth the corporate investment, were worth having our needs accommodated. Everyone's choices are different. You have to figure out what you need so you can look in the mirror and feel comfortable with the person you see. And you have to be honest about what you're willing to give up. My choice was to follow my gut and stay more at home. I know I'm unbelievably fortunate. If my gut had told me to work full-time, I could have well afforded the help that would have let me do it. And today, I do know plenty of women who not only have great kids, but also work much more than a 40-hour week. Their marriages are fine, their kids are flourishing, and so are their careers. I applaud them. It just isn't me. There are all kinds of good mothers. Figure out what kind of parent you want to be, and don't compare yourself to anyone else. I had to have a conversation with myself. Which would make me feel worse? If my kids said, "You never help me with my homework, you're never around," or if Diane Sawyer got the Boris Yeltsin interview. For me, the first is worse, because I couldn't handle the guilt if my kids told me that. Now, I am around my kids all the time, and they say that kind of thing anyway to manipulate me. But the difference is I let it roll off my back, because I know it's not true. If it were true, the guilt for me would be intolerable. And by the way, I don't presume to say I'd even win the Yeltsin interview, no matter how much time I did or didn't spend with my kids. Anyway, guilt is my gut talking to me, and I organize a lot of my life around guilt avoidance. There is a certain amount of attention and involvement I feel I need to give my kids, and if it's less than that, I feel bad. Today, my world revolves around their schedules, their traumas, their dramas. I have to be aware of what's going on in their classroom, what's happening with their homework, what the best friends are doing, and how all the little girl and little boy machinations and rivalries are playing out. The children are taken to school by their father or me, and I'm the one who picks them up and shuttles them to soccer and dance team and playdates and doctor's appointments. I always try to get a little help, though. I'm the carpool driver. Today, overall, I spend much more time being a mother than trying to book an interview with the First Lady. The most important time on my clock is 3:30 p.m. when school is out. I try to turn the phones off from 4 to 8 so I can focus on playing with my kids and monitoring homework. Now, because of that, I've sometimes